Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, September 15th, 2021. Simone Biles and other U.S. Olympic gymnasts, who are among the hundreds of young girls who were sexually abused by former team doctor Larry Nassar, accusing the FBI of turning a blind eye to the credible reports of abuse in testimony before a Senate committee. Biles saying she not only blames Nassar, but an entire system that enabled and perpetuated his abuse. FBI Director Christopher Wray also testifying and apologizing and promising things will change. We'll have more from the hearing in just a moment. President Joe Biden says he has great confidence in General Mark Milley, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as some top Republicans are calling on Milley to resign or be fired. This after excerpts from an upcoming book describe Milley taking precautionary steps to keep former President Donald Trump, defeated for re-election, from launching what was feared could be a military attack against China. U.S. House Ways and Means Committee finishing up work on its portions of the $3.5 trillion social spending and tax bill, the one known as budget reconciliation, as President Joe Biden meets one-on-one with two Democratic senators who, at the moment, are reluctant to go along with that price tag, and their votes will be needed for passage. We'll get the latest from Politico reporter Burgess Everett. And what political lessons come from Democratic California Governor Gavin Newsom's relatively easy win in a recall election Tuesday over Maine opponent Republican Larry Elder? We'll check in with LA Times columnist Mark Z. Baraback. And now to the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. This from CNN. U.S. gymnast Simone Biles, Michaela Maroney, Ali Reisman, and Maggie Nichols blasted the FBI and Justice Department's handling of the Larry Nassar investigation during their Senate testimony. Nassar, a former USA Gymnastics and Michigan State University doctor, was sentenced to 40 to 175 years in prison after more than 150 women and girls said he sexually abused them over the past two decades. The Justice Department's Inspector General found FBI officials investigating the allegations violated the agency's policies by making false statements and failing to properly document complaints by the accusers. That was all from CNN. Here is a portion of Simone Biles' opening statement.
To be clear, I blame Larry Nassar, and I also blame an entire system that enabled and perpetrated his abuse. USA Gymnastics and the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee knew that I was abused by their official team doctor long before I was ever made aware of their knowledge. In May of 2015, Rhonda Fayen, the former head of USA Gymnastics women's program, was told by my friend and teammate, Maggie Nichols, that she suspected I, too, was a victim. I didn't understand the magnitude of what all was happening until the Indianapolis Star published its article in the fall of 2016, entitled, Former USA Gymnastics Doctor Accused of Abuse. Yet while I was a member of the 2016 U.S. Olympic team, neither USAG, USOPC, nor the FBI ever contacted me or my parents. While others had been informed and investigations were ongoing, I had been left to wonder why I was not told until after the Rio Games. This is the largest case of sexual abuse in the history of American sport. And although there have been a fully independent investigation of the FBI's handling of the case, neither USAG nor USOPC have ever been made the subject of the same level of scrutiny. These are the entities entrusted with the protection of our sport and our athletes, and yet it feels like questions of responsibility and organizational failures remain unanswered. As you pursue the answers to those questions, I ask that your work be guided by the same question that Rachel Denhollander and many others have asked. How much is a little girl worth? I sit before you today to raise my voice so that no little girl must endure what I, the athletes at this table, and the countless others who needlessly suffered under Nassar's guise of medical treatment, which we continue to endure today. We suffered and continue to suffer because no one at FBI, USAG, or the USOPC did what was necessary to protect us. We have been failed, and we deserve answers. Nassar is where he belongs, but those who enabled him deserve to be held accountable. If they are not, I am convinced that this will continue to happen to others across Olympic sports. In reviewing the OIG's report, it truly feels like the FBI turned a blind eye to us and went out of its way to help protect USAG and USOPC. A message needs to be sent. If you allow a predator to harm children, the consequences will be swift and severe. Enough is enough.
Gymnast Simone Biles before the Senate Judiciary Committee. USAG is United States of America Gymnastics, the national governing body for gymnastics in the U.S., USOPC, the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee. Another witness today, gymnast Michaela Maroney, saying that FBI agents lied about what she told them of the abuse that she suffered from Larry Nassar, and now she wants the truth to be known.
After telling my entire story of abuse to the FBI in the summer of 2015, not only did the FBI not report my abuse, but when they eventually documented my report 17 months later, they made entirely false claims about what I said. After reading the Office of Inspector General's OIG report, I was shocked and deeply disappointed at this narrative they chose to fabricate. They chose to lie about what I said and protect a serial child molester rather than protect not only me, but countless others. My story is one in which Special Agent in Charge Jay Abbott and his subordinates did not want you to hear. And it's time that I tell you. In the summer of 2015, like I said, I was scheduled to speak to the FBI about my abuse with Larry Nassar over the phone. I was too sick to go meet with anyone in person, and talking about this abuse would give me PTSD for days. But I chose to speak about it to try and make a difference and protect others. I remember sitting on my bedroom floor for nearly 3 hours as I told them what happened to me. I hadn't even told my own mother about these facts, but I thought, as uncomfortable and as hard as it was to tell my story, I was going to make a difference, and hopefully protecting others from the same abuse. I answered all of their questions honestly and clearly, and I disclosed all of my molestations I had endured by Nassar to them in extreme detail. They told me to start from the beginning. I told them about the sport of gymnastics, how you make the national team, and how I came to meet Larry Nassar when I was 13 at a Texas camp. I told them that the first thing Larry Nassar ever said to me was to change into shorts with no underwear because that would make it easier for him to work on me. And within minutes, he had his fingers in my vagina. The FBI then immediately asked, "Did he insert his fingers into your rectum?" I said, "No, he never did." They asked if he used gloves. I said, "No, he never did." They asked if this treatment ever helped me. I said, "No, it never did. This treatment was 100% abuse and never gave me any relief." I then told the FBI about Tokyo, the day he gave me a sleeping pill for the plane ride to then work on me later that night. That evening, I was naked, completely alone, with him on top of me, molesting me for hours. I told them I thought I was going to die that night because there was no way that he would let me go. But he did. I told them I walked the halls of Tokyo Hotel at 2 a.m. at only 15 years old. I began crying at the memory over the phone, and there was just dead silence. I was so shocked at the agent's silence and disregard for my trauma. After that minute of silence, he asked, "Is that all?" Those words in itself was one of the worst moments of this entire process for me.
Michaela Maroney, one of the four gymnasts at today's Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. She explained that she testified to that she spoke to the FBI in 2015 over the phone because she was too sick to go in person. More from CNN. The Justice Department's Inspector General's report found that FBI Special Agent in Charge W.J. Abbott and Supervisory Special Agent Michael Langman conducted a limited follow-up investigation in 2015 and neglected to interview two of the three accusers. Following the Inspector General's report, the Justice Department declined to prosecute Abbott and Langman. Abbott retired and Langman was fired in recent weeks. Back to today's hearing. After the gymnast testified, there was a second panel of witnesses that included the FBI Director Christopher Wray and the Inspector General of the Justice Department, Michael Horowitz. Director Wray began with an apology.
On behalf of the entire FBI, I want to begin by saying to the brave women who testified here this morning, Ms. Biles, Ms. Maroney, Ms. Nichols and Ms. Raisman, and I gather there were some others here today who were among the many who Nassar hurt. I'm deeply and profoundly sorry to each and every one of you. I'm sorry for what you and your families have been through. I'm sorry that so many different people let you down over and over again. And I'm especially sorry that there were people at the FBI who had their own chance to stop this monster back in 2015 and failed. And that is inexcusable. It never should have happened, and we're doing everything in our power to make sure it never happens again. Now, before I became FBI director, I was generally familiar with the Nassar story shortly after his arrest in 2016, and I remember even then being appalled that there were so many people who had failed to do their jobs and keep these young women safe from that predator. But after I became FBI director, and when I learned that there were people at the FBI who had also failed these women, I was heartsick and furious. I immediately ordered a special review by our inspection division to try to get to the bottom of it. That review led in part to the Inspector General's own review, and I'm grateful to Inspector General Horowitz for his team's extensive and independent work. I want to be crystal clear. The actions and inaction of the FBI employees detailed in this report are totally unacceptable. These individuals betrayed the core duty that they have of protecting people. They failed to protect young women and girls from abuse. And the work we do certainly is often complicated and uncertain, and we're never going to be perfect. But the kinds of fundamental errors that were made in this case in 2015 and 16 should never have happened, period. And as long as I'm FBI director, I'm committed to doing everything in my power to make sure they never happen again.
Director Christopher Wray. Several senators on the Judiciary Committee saying they're pressing the Justice Department to prosecute the FBI employees who failed to take proper action against Larry Nassar following the reports that he abused girls. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat from Connecticut, today asking Director Wray about the timing of one of the agents fired in the case.
Michael Langman has been fired. When was he fired? Last week?
I don't have the exact date for you, but it was within the last, I think it was within the last week.
Why wasn't he fired earlier?
Well, we waited until we had the Inspector General's report, so we had all the facts, so we understood the totality as independently investigated of his conduct. And then we followed our disciplinary process because one of the things that is in keeping with my insistence that everybody in the FBI do things in the right way includes making sure that we follow our disciplinary process in the right way. And we did that, and he's been fired under that process.
Someone perhaps more cynical than I would have perhaps concluded that it was the hearing here staring the FBI in the face that prompted that action, but I'm not going to go there because I think what's more important than the firing is, in fact, the criminal prosecution. And here, I think there are really fundamental issues of fairness and law enforcement.
Senator Richard Blumenthal questioning the FBI Director Christopher Wray. Wray also saying today that the FBI's handling of the Larry Nassar case is so shocking to him because it's inconsistent with other FBI child abuse investigations. He said that over the past 5 years, there have been 16,000 arrests in child abuse cases. Senator Mazie Hirono, Democrat from Hawaii, asking Wray about the training that agents who handle these types of cases receive.
Director Wray, you testified that you've run out of adjectives to really describe the horror that you feel as to what happened in this case. But frankly, the sexual assault and abuse of girls, women, children, those most vulnerable in our society has been going on since time immemorial. And I don't think we do a great job of investigating these kinds of crimes. And certainly, you know, the military, the sexual assault in the military is an ongoing scourge, or in law enforcement. And so we have a situation where it's very clear that in your Indianapolis field office, you had a person in charge there who I think exhibited a certain kind of attitude. Mr. Horowitz says a kind of a mindset that I've concluded says that as far as he was concerned, these kinds of crimes were not much of a big deal. It was not a big deal. It is really a mindset. So I'm glad to know, Director Ray, that you do provide specialized training for those agents or those people within the FBI who deal with these kinds of crimes. That's what you testified, correct?
Yes, Senator. We have actually a number of different kinds of training. One that is mandatory for all employees, regardless of whether they work these cases, that emphasizes their obligation to report abuse, even if they're not working these kinds of cases. But then the second, which is, I think, what you're referring to, is specifically geared towards people who handle these kinds of cases and their supervisors. And the new training that we've put in place in the wake of the Inspector General's report adds into it the lessons learned. It talks about all the policies and procedure changes that I've testified here today about, but it also talks about the lessons learned, the painful lessons learned from this particular case.
Well, apparently neither Mr. Abbott or the second agent in your Indianapolis office had that kind of training, correct?
Well, they had earlier forms of training that before I joined the FBI, they didn't have the training, obviously, that we put in place since the report, because they're both gone.
That's the thing about this kind of training, that, you know, you don't change hearts and minds because somebody goes through this kind of training, and that is why the kind of follow-up or whatever you put in place to make sure that, that the kind of mindset that conveys to the survivors of crimes like this, that whatever happened to them is not a big deal or they are not believed.
Senator Mazie Hirono questioning the FBI Director Christopher Wray at today's Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. C-SPAN broadcast the hearing live in its entirety, and you can find the full video archived at cspan.org. This is Washington Today. From the Associated Press, the top U.S. military officer on Wednesday defended the phone calls he made to his Chinese counterpart in the turbulent final months of Donald Trump's presidency, saying the conversations were intended to convey reassurance to the Chinese military and were in line with his responsibilities as chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Some in Congress accused General Mark Milley of having overstepped his authority and urged President Joe Biden to fire him. But Biden indicated Wednesday he stands behind Milley.
Sir, did General Milley do the right thing, sir?
Thank you. Let's go. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
General Milley do the right thing.
I have great confidence in General Milley.
Thank you, guys. Let's go. Thank you.
President Biden answering a reporter's question at the start of a White House meeting on a different subject. He was meeting with business executives talking about COVID vaccine mandates. More from the AP story. General Milley's phone calls were described in excerpts from the forthcoming book Peril by Washington Post journalists Bob Woodward and Robert Costa. Milley, fearful of Trump's actions in his final weeks as president, twice called his Chinese counterpart to assure him that the U.S. was not going to attack China. Earlier in the afternoon, before President Biden's remarks, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki asked about the administration's position.
A new book reports that near the end of the Trump presidency, Chairman Milley had two conversations with his Chinese counterpart, promising the countries would not go to war and that he would give an early warning if something were to happen. In a statement just minutes ago, Chairman Milley did not dispute this account. On this, does the president feel that these calls were appropriate? Does he have confidence in the chairman? And some Republican senators have called for Chairman Milley to be dismissed. Is he going to keep his job?
Well, I saw the statement, of course, that the Department of Defense, or I should say the Joint Chiefs spokesperson, just released minutes ago. I'm not going to add more or speak to anonymous, unconfirmed reports about conversations with limited context from here. But what I can assure you all of is that the president knows General Milley. He has been chairman of the Joint Chiefs for almost 8 months of his presidency. They've worked side by side through a range of international events. And the president has complete confidence in his leadership, his patriotism, and his fidelity to our Constitution. Since you gave me the opportunity, I just wanted to add, I think it's important to consider some of the context, key context of this period in time, of time in history that we're discussing and is outlined or covered in portions of this book. The outgoing president of the United States during this period of time, fomented unrest, leading to an insurrection and an attack on our nation's capital on January 6th, which we've all, you all have covered extensively, of course, one of the darkest days in our nation's history. Beyond reports in this book, there's been widespread reporting and commentary from members of his own cabinet, the former president's cabinet, I should say, including high-ranking national security officials, questioning the former president's stability, his behavior, and his suitability to oversee the national security of the United States. So those are important questions that need to be discussed as well.
The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. Over at the Pentagon, Press Secretary John Kirby asked about General Milley's calls to his Chinese counterpart and also reports in that book, Peril, that General Milley called a secret meeting of senior military officials on January 8th to review the process for military action, including launching nuclear weapons, and instructing those in charge of the National Military Command Center not to take orders from anyone without his involvement. Here is the Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby.
John, there are two allegations in the new Woodward Costa book that have to do with this building in particular, whether General Milley inserted himself into the nuclear launch process. Is there anything unusual that you've seen or that is the Defense Secretary concerned about the reports that General Milley inserted himself into the, tried to stop the president at the time from having the ability to launch nuclear weapons? Can you explain how the process works? And it's been explained to us that he went and just went through, reviewed the procedures, and that he told them that they he should be on any conference call with the president, that that's part of the procedures. Is that part of the nuclear procedures? I'm confused.
Well, I certainly can't speak to the revelations that are coming out in the book. I think you saw a statement by the chairman's office specifically addressing this issue. What I can tell you is that it is not uncommon at all for the department to continue to review security protocols, particularly when it comes to our strategic deterrence capabilities, that we constantly take a look at the protocols and the procedures to make sure that they are still relevant. And these protocols have been in place for a long time, a couple of decades, and so it's not uncommon. It's also completely appropriate, and again, I'm not speaking to the validity of things that are in the book, but it is completely appropriate for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as the senior military advisor to both the secretary and the president, to want to see those protocols reviewed on whatever frequent basis that he wants to do that. So, again, I can't speak to the validity, but I see nothing in what I've read that would cause any concern.
What is the chairman's role in terms of the nuclear launch, if there were a nuclear launch by the president?
Well, the chairman is the key military advisor to the president, to the commander-in-chief. And in a sequence of events whereby a commander-in-chief would be making that decision, that most grave of decisions, the chairman would be intimately involved in that process, in providing advice and counsel to both the secretary and to the president. Obviously, the president in this case makes the final decision. And, you know, by statute, by law, he is the prime military advisor to the president, and this would be a military decision of profound proportions here and importance. So he would be absolutely involved in that process, soup to nuts.
And was there anything unusual said to the Chinese counterpart in the phone calls, as far as you understand?
Well, again, all I've seen is the same reporting that you've seen, Jen. I can't speak to the specifics of the conversation, a conversation that took place obviously before this administration took office. But I would add, if I may, again, that it is not only common, it's expected that a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff would continue to have counterpart conversations. I mean, he is basically the chief of defense for the United States. We don't call him that. But he has chief of defense counterparts around the world. And having worked for a chairman myself for quite a bit, I can tell you frequent communication with two countries like Russia and China is not atypical at all for a chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And those communications are they're routine, they're staffed, they're coordinated, and they're transparent, as transparent as they can be.
The Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby. This from Fox News. Former Acting Secretary of Defense Christopher Miller, who led the Pentagon from the period after the 2020 election through Inauguration Day, said that he did not and would not ever authorize Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Mark Milley to have secret calls with his Chinese counterpart, describing the allegations as a disgraceful and unprecedented act of insubordination, calling on him to resign immediately. And Senator Marco Rubio, Republican and Vice Chair of the Intelligence Committee, putting out a statement also calling for the general to be fired or resign, saying that Milley worked to actively undermine the sitting commander-in-chief of the United States Armed Forces and contemplated a treasonous leak of classified information to the Chinese Communist Party in advance of a potential armed conflict with the People's Republic of China. Former President Donald Trump telling Newsmax this week that General Milley's fear that he would attack China was unfounded.
If it is actually true, which is hard to believe, that he would have called China and done these things and was willing to advise them of an attack or in advance of an attack, that's treason. And I would think I've had so many calls today saying that's treason, number one. Number two, it's totally ridiculous. I never thought of it. You were there. You knew what was happening in the White House. You have plenty of friends. You never heard the word China mentioned in a thing like this. You heard a lot of anger about China on trade, and we made a great trade deal. You heard a lot of anger on China with the China virus. But for him to say that I would even think about attacking China, I think he's trying to just get out of his incompetent withdrawal out of Afghanistan.
Former President Donald Trump interviewed by Newsmax on Tuesday. General Mark Milley is scheduled to testify about the withdrawal from Afghanistan before the Senate Armed Services Committee on September 28th. He, of course, might get asked about other issues as well. C-SPAN will be carrying that hearing live. And Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcast. A few more headlines. The Biden administration will begin requiring immigrants to be fully vaccinated against coronavirus before they can become permanent residents. That starts October 1st. The U.S. already requires those seeking residency to have several other vaccinations, including for measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox. Exemptions for medical and religious reasons are allowed. Pope Francis asked whether President Biden and other politicians who support abortion should be denied communion. Pope not giving a yes or no answer, saying he didn't know the U.S. case well enough. But he repeated that abortion is homicide and Catholic priests cannot give the Eucharist to someone who is not in communion with the Church. And the Pope says Catholic bishops must minister to politicians who support abortion with compassion and tenderness, not condemnation. The U.S. House of Representatives Ways and Means Committee finishing up the markup of the $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation bill. Took 4 days, 35 hours. They were the final committee to approve their portions. Today's party line vote was 24-19. Democrats, yes. Republicans, no. Their bill includes an expansion of social programs, including child care, family leave, and Medicare, also climate change programs, plus tax credits and some tax increases on companies and wealthy individuals to pay for it all. The committee ranking Republican Kevin Brady offered an amendment today to keep the corporate tax rate at 21%. Democrats want to raise it to 26.5%. His amendment was voted down. Here is Congressman Brady, followed by Democratic Congressman Glenn Thompson.
After that humiliating surrender to the Taliban in Afghanistan, we are not going to surrender economically to China, to Russia, to Europe or Japan. We are not sending jobs, manufacturing, research, investment overseas. It's all staying here in America where it belongs. We are going to continue to be the most competitive economy in the world. We are not going to have the worst tax rates in the world. No one yet told us what's wrong with 21% because that gave us the opportunity to grow our economy, grow paychecks, grow jobs, and yeah, grew household income more in 1 year than on all 8 years Joe Biden was in the White House last time. We're going to continue to lift our people out of poverty, not China. We're going to create more opportunity for people of color, low income, low skilled, all those left behind by the Obama-Biden worst economic recovery in our lifetimes. And no, we're not going to punish Americans for investing in America. We need that investment in our businesses, our struggling communities, in our economy. So no, capital gains will not go higher than China's. Why all this? Because this isn't about corporations or the wealthy. It's about workers. It's about families and customers and retirees and communities that our businesses invest in. They bear the burden. They always bear the burden. We saw this last time Joe Biden was in the White House. Slow growth, stagnant paychecks, jobs moving overseas. It was so bad that after 8 years in office, most Americans thought they were still in a recession. Workers, customers, retirees whose retirement depend upon the success of the business, the communities that were hurt so bad, whenever a week it seemed like we read about a new U.S. company moving overseas, picking up and leaving communities devastated. That's not going to happen again under this amendment. We're not going to repeat that mistake. We are going to build back in America, not China. And that, Mr. Chairman, is the title of this amendment. Build back in America, not China. I yield back.
Thank the gentleman. Does the gentleman from California continue to insist upon his point of order?
No, Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw my point of order, but I'd like to speak on the on my friend's amendment.
The gentleman from California is recognized on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I urge all of my colleagues to vote against this, and I'll just take the ranking member at his word, and that is that he wants to help the workers. And I just want to remind folks that that's exactly what our bill does. It helps the workers. There's a child tax credit, an earned income tax credit, renewable energy to deal with this incredible devastation that's being brought about by climate change, better health care, better schools, better education. This is about the people that we represent. And remember that the corporate rate was 35% for 25 years before Congress lowered it to 21% in 2017. And many of you were on the committee when the Republicans pushed that bill through. And I don't think any of us ever heard from anyone in corporate America that we should lower that to 21%. I had visits from folks who wanted it down to 28%, some 25, but no one, the people that benefit from this, no one came to us and said, it's got to be 21%. This was just a flat giveaway to corporations. So the proposed rate in our bill of 26.5% is still very low by historic standards and very fair. And this amendment also conveniently ignores the fact that we're lowering the corporate rate for small businesses and holding businesses with under $5 million in taxable income. We're holding those folks harmless on this. I don't think it's too much to ask corporations to pay a bit more into the system in order to help families, to help workers, to help our communities, and to help our environment in regard to addressing climate change. So I would urge a no vote on this, Mr. Chairman, and I yield back the balance of my time.
Democratic Congressman Glenn Thompson, and before that, Republican Kevin Brady, before the Brady Amendment was voted down by the House Ways and Means Committee. The committee continuing its markup of the $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation bill. First line in an article by Burgess Everett, co-congressional bureau chief with Politico, is President Joe Biden is set to meet with Democrats' two most prominent holdouts on their massive social spending package, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Burgess Everett joining us now. Thanks for doing this. First, what does it say that President Biden himself is getting involved in these negotiations?
It says to me that the internal sort of caucus wrangling between the different senators and the different factions is not necessarily proving super productive at this point. You kind of have a lot of Manchin versus Bernie storylines going on. They even sort of squared off on the Sunday shows over the weekend. And I think the way that Democrats that want to pass this agenda, that want a big $3.5 trillion spending bill, they want to present this as this is Joe Biden's agenda. This isn't Bernie Sanders' agenda. This isn't Elizabeth Warren's agenda. This isn't Joe Manchin's agenda. This is the president's agenda, and that is the path they see towards actually getting this done.
You also write that during a lunch on Tuesday with other Senate Democrats, Manchin reiterated his hopes to pause the spending package, according to an attendee, a statement that met with crickets.
Yeah, I mean, he has been pretty upfront about this. He doesn't see the role. He wants to see how the rest of the agenda plays out. We have a debt ceiling increase that needs to be done in the next month. We have a spending bill deadline at the end of September. So I think Joe Manchin does not necessarily see the urgency, especially as he keeps highlighting increasing inflation. A lot of other folks see it that way, and Sinema has not publicly called for the same sort of pause that Manchin has, so he's a little bit on an island. And Democrats are very polite, so they don't usually argue with each other at these lunches anyway, but if you don't get any applause, it kind of shows that nobody in the room necessarily agrees with where you're coming from.
Have either senator given any specifics on what they want as an alternative to the $3.5 trillion?
Not in terms of a number. Manchin has sort of batted around $1.5 trillion, which would probably be unacceptable to other to progressive Democrats, but that may be his starting position. If the, you know, if that's his low position and the high position is 3.5, maybe they settle somewhere in there. I think probably the most obvious solution would be to present the bill in a way that it's completely paid for, to get not just Manchin and Sinema on board, but several other moderates who want it to be paid for, and that would mostly be done with changes to the tax code. But Democrats are likely to use dynamic scoring in there, too, which sort of assumed economic growth, which Republicans used to pass their tax bill in 2017. So if they can make those two things add up to, say, $2.5 trillion, I think there's some thought in the Democratic caucus that they'd be able to get everyone to go along.
We're talking with Burgess Everett from Politico. Well, today, September 15th, was the deadline that Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer had set to get a final bill done in the Senate. That's probably not going to happen. So where do things go from here?
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of aspirational. I think he probably knew that even at the time, but it's a way of, you know, fostering debate and moving things forward, which is really his job as Majority Leader. On the House side, I mean, they're moving pieces of this legislation. I'm just not sure how much of it is going to be in an ultimate bill, because the margins are small in the House to begin with, and there is no margin in the Senate. You literally can't lose a single vote. And so in that way, kind of the loudest, squeakiest wheels are going to dictate what the ultimate package looks like. And so to boil it down as simply as possible, whatever Joe Manchin will support in the end, or Sinema, whichever one kind of emerges as the tougher vote, or them together, is going to be what can pass the Senate and House and go to the president's desk.
Burgess Everett is co-congressional bureau chief with Politico. Read his articles at politico.com. Thank you very much.
Hey, of course. No problem. Happy to do it.
On Wall Street today, the Dow was up 236, NASDAQ up 123, S&P up 37. President Biden saying in a statement that 2.8 million consumers took advantage of a special six-month period this year to sign up for subsidized health insurance coverage that was made more affordable by the COVID-19 relief law. And overall now, 12.2 million Americans are enrolled in coverage under the Affordable Care Act. That's up 20% since the end of last year. From the Hill newspaper, top Democrats touting California Governor Gavin Newsom's victory in Tuesday's recall election as a harbinger of what's to come in the 2022 midterms, when the party will have to defend a narrow House and Senate majority. In a Wednesday morning conference call with reporters, the chair of the Democratic National Committee, Jamie Harrison, and Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney, chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, saying Newsom's win underscored their party's greatest hope heading into next year's midterm elections, that voters will deliver a sweeping rejection of the GOP under the continued influence of former President Trump. Governor Newsom stays governor because 64% of California voters voted no on the recall. The governor celebrated Tuesday night.
We may have defeated Trump, but Trumpism is not dead in this country. The big lie, January 6th insurrection, all the voting suppression efforts that are happening all across this country, what's happening, the assault on fundamental rights, constitutionally protected rights of women and girls, It's a remarkable moment in our nation's history. But I'm reminded of something, I don't know, a few decades ago someone told me when describing a difficult and challenging moment, said, the world is too small, our time is too short, and our wisdom is too limited to win fleeting victories at other people's expenses. And he went on to say, we must all triumph together. So in that spirit of recognizing and reconciling this moment and trying to understand what's going on, not just here in this state, but all across the United States of America, I just want to say this. Tonight, I'm humbled, grateful, but resolved in the spirit of my political hero, Robert Kennedy, to make more gentle the life of this world.
California Governor Gavin Newsom, Democrat, Tuesday night after the results of the recall election came in. Out of the few dozen Republican challengers, radio talk show host Larry Elder was leading in the votes and the polls and then the votes to replace Newsom if the recall had been successful. Elder also spoke Tuesday night, urging his supporters to be gracious in defeat, but he also noted that it was a tough election.
When you consider we were outspent by a factor of 5, 6, 7 to 1, I wasn't running just against Gavin Newsom. I was running against the left-wing media. I was running against a newspaper, the LA Times, that referred to me as the black face of white supremacy. I'm running against a newspaper that called me everything but a black David Duke. I'm running against a media that serves as a public relations bureau for the left. And we still scared the bejesus out of them. That's why they brought in Barack Obama. They brought in Bernie Sanders, a socialist who owns 3 homes, but I digress. They brought in Senator Warren. And as I said before, all they did was call this a Republican takeover. I mentioned State Senator Glory Romero. 63% of Hispanics voted for this man just 2 years earlier. And Gloria, you know this, the majority of Hispanics now want him out. Over the issue of school choice. The majority of declined estate voted for him just 2 years ago. Now the majority want him out. And they're calling this a Republican takeover. It is insulting to the people of California who signed that petition and who voted yes on the recall. It is insulting. But that's how they roll. We don't roll that way. We don't finger point. We don't blame, we roll up our sleeves, we get back to it, because as I said before, we may have lost the battle, but we're sure as hell going to win the war.
Larry Elder, the top Republican California gubernatorial candidate, conceding defeat Tuesday night. With more on the California recall election, we're joined by Mark Z. Baraback, Los Angeles Times columnist. Thanks for being with us. The first line in your column today reads, well, that was a complete and utter waste. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, California flushed $276 million down the drain for an election 9 months before a regularly scheduled election. I mean, I want to make the point that I'm not in any way advocating whether or not Gavin Newsom deserves a second term. You can like him, you can not like him. The point was we have an election scheduled. As I said, 9 months from now, this was, I think I also described it as an act of partisan petulance. It was an effort. I mean, I don't want to sound like I am adopting the Newsom campaign's talking points, but they made a legitimate point. This was an effort by Republicans who have not won a statewide office in California since 2006 to win an election they otherwise could not have won under normal circumstances. And again, it was costly, it was unnecessary, and it points to, I feel, a need for California to reform what is a very permissive, very promiscuous recall law.
In fact, you also note that every California governor since 1960 has faced multiple recall attempts.
Yeah, in fact, this was the sixth effort to drive Gavin Newsom from office. I wrote in the column, I said that being California governor comes with certain perks like a car and driver, a security squad, and being a perennial target of recall efforts. California simply makes it too easy to recall or try to recall our governor. There are 19 states that allow for a gubernatorial recall. California has by far the lowest threshold. You only need 12% signatures representing 12% of the votes cast in a prior gubernatorial election, and a very, very long window to gather those signatures. And, you know, 1.5 million sounds like a lot, but this is a state with more than 22 million voters, nearly 40 million residents. And what we have is a 1911 law harnessed into 2021 technology, things that make it very, very easy to go online, to target specific voters. It's simply too easy to have a recall in California. And as I said, it's simply too expensive.
We're talking with Mark Z. Barabak, LA Times columnist. Looking at the results of the recall election, when it comes to policy and politics, what are your takeaways about what the voters care about?
I think the voters care about COVID. That is top of the mind. Polls show that, and anecdotal evidence suggests as much. You know, voters are concerned about drought. Voters are concerned about wildfire. And those latter two, in fact, I would say all three are really beyond the control of any governor. There's no governor who can make COVID go away. There's no governor who can make it rain. There's no governor who can reverse climate change. But those are all important issues to Californians. Homelessness is a really, really big issue. I mean, there were personal things about Gavin Newsom and his style. I don't want to be superficial, but I can't tell you how many times I've heard people comment about his looks, his hair, his teeth, how handsome he is. That puts some people off. But going back to the issues, again, COVID is a huge issue here in California as it is elsewhere. And the polls show that people support what the governor has done on vaccines, on masks. The exit polling that I showed, and you know, admittedly, it's preliminary, but suggests that the governor is on a track that people like. People want masking and they want vaccinations. And although it helped drive the recall, once more, this was a minority view that harnessed this technology that made it possible to put this on the ballot. And as we see from the results, most people, if not entirely crazy about Gavin Newsom, they don't want to throw him out, at least not before his term ends.
Both Governor Newsom and Larry Elder were arguing that whatever the result of the recall election was, it's going to have implications across the country. Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, I don't want to overstate that. I mean, I'm a proud, self-admitted California chauvinist, but I don't presume that what people in Napa or San Diego or Yucaipa are thinking is going to influence people in Mississippi or Missouri or Washington State or Idaho when they go to the ballot. I do think that Democrats looking for a playbook, if you will, for 2022 might take some solace, might take note the fact that, as I said, Gavin Newsom pushed vaccines, he pushed masks. That put a very, very popular position. I think you may see Democrats leaning into that. And I think to the extent they can, Democrats are going to try again to make 2022 a referendum on Donald Trump. Larry Elder in this election was the stand-in for Donald Trump. You know, that worked in California, but again, I think you can't draw too many conclusions. California is a very, very blue, very Democratic state, and what works here isn't going to necessarily work in a lot of purple, lesser-shaded blue, much less red states.
Mark Z. Barabak, columnist with the Los Angeles Times. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening to Washington Today. To get more top Washington stories, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. Go to c-span.org/subscribed in order to sign up. And I hope you have a good evening.